pravidelném magickém semináři.
I have to wear it? All right, it's my totem.
Your totem.
Měli jsme slyšet něco na Necronomiconu, ale abychom dokázali, že skutečná magická společnost, tak jeden z našich kolegů přednášejícího ušknul a ten zalehl se zápalem pryc. Takže praktická magie se povedla, dotyčný, jestliže ten zápal pryc se povede, tak Necronomicon využije prakticky. Jestliže ne, tak nám přijde něco ještě říct. Ale abychom se krátili, dnes nám bude povídat JD. He's going to present everything in English, because he is originally not a Native American, but an American. And he's going to talk about Native American spirituality. If you have any questions, or perhaps you don't understand a specific word, please keep it, and you can ask at the end of the presentation. So JT, proceed.
Thank you. And I will try very hard to speak deliberately, slowly, carefully, so that we are understood. Yeah. Perfect. All right. But so today I was going to talk about Native American magic, culture, spirituality. My background is primarily as a religious philosopher, and I'm adding to that a little bit about magic specifically. I should begin with this little excuse. The subject is big. In North America alone, there are 9 major language groups. By contrast, most of Europe and a large part of Asia has only one language group, the Indo-Aryan language. So the differences between the Athabascan and the Ojibwa are significantly larger than the differences between the Germans and the Persians. The language is radically different. The culture is radically different. They have practically nothing in common, except they're all Native Americans. With this in mind, I'm going to talk about what they have in common, which is, in a large way, their religious practice. The Native American cultures are very synchronistic. When speaking about synchronism in religion, what we mean is they accept each other's myths. They believe that they are all talking about the same thing. In a European context, one of the most famous synchronists was Alexander the Great. When he conquered Egypt, he said, "Yes, yes, you want to worship Egyptian gods? That's fine. They're the same as our gods. You just have a different name for them." And this is what the Native Americans generally did. It is often said that Native Americans did not fight over religion, and this is very true. They fought over land, they fought over wealth, they fought over women, they fought over all kinds of things, but not religion. You want to say Wakanda, and I say Wakantak? Fine. We're both talking about the great mystery that is life. We just have different words for it. This may make it seem like words are not important, but they are. In fact, words are centrally important to everything in Native American religious practice. And we're going to talk about that in a little while as well. But first of all, I want to bring up magic, because magic is the point of these lectures. And I must admit that I don't spend a lot of time thinking about magic. It's simply a part of mythic systems, the way different people activate their spirituality. So I went and I spent a little time, first of all, in the good old-fashioned dictionary. Merriam-Webster's dictionary, which is the standard English dictionary, gives us... Merriam-Webster's, by the way, is a dictionary that came from the union of Merriam's dictionary and Webster's dictionary. They synchronized. It's the standard American English dictionary. And they say this, several definitions of magic, including tricks of hand, etc. The definition that is important for us is this. The use of means, such as charms or spells, believed to have supernatural power over natural forces. The use of means, the use of something, charms, words, spells, to give supernatural power over the natural world. The Native Americans would not agree. None of the major nine language groups, they would say, what is supernatural? What is natural? What is the difference? How do words give supernatural power over the natural world when words are part of the natural world? When magic is part of the natural world? When the natural world is supernatural? That's the key to all of this. I also thought, I spent a little time thinking and putting together an idea comparing some other ideas of magic. And I came up with three different definitions that I think are very important for us as we begin. The first is from a man named Donald Tyson. Donald Tyson is a Canadian author. He has written many books on magic. He says, magic is the art of affecting the manifest through the unmanifest. And then he gives us a long description of this, including arguing that there is a world of, let's call it essences, Platonic essences, even, supernatural world that has influence over the natural. That's basically what Mr. Merriam and Webster told us. So the first of our definitions of magic we will call Platonic magic, the divide between the world of essence and the world of existence, or the supernatural and the natural. The second definition of magic that came to me, I don't have a quote from it, but I can just tell a story. There is a woman named Starhawk. She's Native American, but she makes a lot of money selling books on magic to silly suburban girls. No insult to young women. But her books are titled Candle Magic for Beginners, things like this. Well, and she lives in San Francisco, and I've been aware of her for many, many years. And I had a hard time being interested in her. But one day I decided to go listen to a lecture from her. And she explained that for her, magic has a very different meaning. Magic is not transformation of the other. I don't do a spell to change you. I do magic to change me. We could almost call this the Pelagian definition of magic after the early Christian heretic Pelagius, who argued that Christianity was a religion of self-transformation. This is very popular in the States. Starhawk sells a lot of books. She speaks at a lot of rallies. She claims to have some kind of Native American wisdom, but I don't see it. Her definition of magic is almost typically suburban American. It's how to help yourself. Self-help manual. Yeah. Guides to dating tips. This sort of thing. How to be a better lover. That sort of thing. So that's the second definition of magic that I thought of. And the third I found from Mr. Lamborn, Peter Lamborn Wilson, also known as Hakim Bey, for those of you who read Hakim Bey. By the way, this book is in Czech. I know because I've seen it. Sorcery, the systematic cultivation of enhanced consciousness or non-ordinary awareness and its deployment in the world of deeds and objects to bring about desired results. In other words, we do magic not to transform ourselves, not to transform others, but to see reality, to see what is actually there. We do magic, we do ritual, we do spells to wake ourselves up, in the Buddhist sense, and notice what's actually going on around us. Keep that in your mind, because I think Mr. Bey, despite the fact that he's a old fat white guy, as opposed to a Native American like Starhawk, I think this is a much closer definition to the traditional Native American attitude towards religion. We do rituals, we do spells, we do vision quests and sweat lodges to awaken. We don't even need a bodhisattva tree, but they help. But what really helps is words. Words like I'm using right now. Before I get into that, I want to talk a little bit about Native American culture, what it is as we know it today. So a little history, if you'll let me, please. There is no such thing as traditional Native American culture. It doesn't exist. This surprises people a lot. But think about this. When Europeans began traveling to the Americas, they brought with them things like guns and horses and sheep and cows, things that did not exist in North America. But they also brought with them germs, diseases, which spread very, very quickly. By the time English began settling in North America, fair time after the Spanish arrived, these diseases had already spread and had wiped out whole cultures, civilizations. For example, where the city of St. Louis is today, there was once a very thriving Indian city, about 40, 50,000 people, completely gone. When the French explorers got there, they found a lot of moldering bodies and an otherwise empty city. When the English settled in New England and the East Coast, they thought that North America was a gift from God because the Indians were already wiped out. It's estimated that somewhere between 80 and 90% of the Native Americans died before there were any wars, programs, genocides, before anybody was actually shot and killed. It was just the diseases. And by the way, the Indians got back. They got their revenge. Native American diseases did come this way also. And some of our most celebrated people had their lives cut short because of syphilis, which came from North America and which Native Americans seldom died of, but Europeans dropped by the thousands, hundreds of thousands. So this didn't shock Europe so much. Europe had already had the plagues, you know. There was plenty of death in Europe, but it really shocked the Native Americans. 80-90% of the people killed. So in this room, let's say you three and me live. You and everybody else, I'm sorry, but it's finished. What would that do to the culture? Well, it would basically end it. And the culture would have to be reborn by the survivors. And that's exactly what happened. The cultures were reinvented by the survivors. When I say that there is no such thing as traditional Indian society, that's what I mean. And the rebirth took place in many ways. For example, the Lakota, or the Sioux, as they are often called. By the way, if you meet a Lakota, don't call him a Sioux. The word Sioux is a Minikonju word, a different nation used the word, and it basically means snake fucker. They don't like being called it. Their word is Lakota. The Lakota people lived in villages along riversides, and when the plagues came up, they fled their villages onto the high plains, where they had a very difficult time surviving until horses got away from the Spanish, and they got horses. One of the major nations of the Lakota, one of the seven families of the Lakota, is called the Black Kettle People, because the man who founded this particular subsect of the Lakota famously stole a giant metal pot from somebody, from some Spanish settler, and they had a big metal pot, so they were the Black Kettle. These are just examples of how Indian culture, Indian nation, Indian identity was reinvented as European settlers arrived. So what we know about Native Americans is not ancient. It's modern. It has, you know, basically, you know, Protestantism, Hussite religion, is older than the Lakota people. On the other hand, not every Indian nation was wiped out this way. The Hopi, for example, have lived in the same villages, in the same cities and towns, for roughly 4,000 years. They truly are an ancient culture. So when I say there are none, I don't want to say none of them. But basically and mostly, what we're going to be talking about is a reinvention of the culture. With this in mind, the history of the plagues, the desperate need of the survivors to rebuild some kind of cultural identity, it's no surprise that for Native Americans, healing is the most important magic. How is healing done? Well, a number of different ways, but the most important way is by accepting death. When a Navajo healer performs the red ant ceremony, which is a literally, the sick man would lie down on a table, and the shaman would put little specks of red all over him and tell the sick man that these are ants, and they are climbing inside of him, and they are going to climb all the way through his system, and they will kill him. And he should accept his death willingly, because it will allow him to be reborn as himself. But if he fights against the ants, if he fights against the death, then he won't be reborn. The healing won't work. Now, this might make it sound as though the shaman has some power, or that the ants, the red ants climbing inside, has some power, but they don't. The real power, in generally speaking, again, 9 different language groups, a huge variety of cultures, generally speaking, it's the word and the words that are spoken. Now, Margot Astro, who is was a Chippewa woman, she died a few years ago, and a professor of anthropology. Most of the people I will be quoting are both very well educated in many different systems, including their own ethnic identity. She describes a word. It is, for them, a word has no essence. It has no Platonic essence. It has no otherworldly character. A word is potential. It's action waiting to happen. And when a shaman speaks words, what he is doing is he's activating that potential. Specifically, she says, a word is a tool designed not to perpetuate, as in to transmit or to make a copy of an idea, but to actuate, to bring change, and to clear obstruction so as to renew habituation. Now, what this means is that these words, unlike in the Greek philosophic sense, these words don't exist out there somewhere waiting to be spoken. They exist right here waiting to be activated. Now, she gives an excellent example of this coming from Chippewa, but I'm not sure about that on the top of my head. A myth about the village of stories. Somewhere over many hills, there's a village where all the stories live. And they live just like you and I live. Falling in love, having children, having fights, jealousies, disagreements, getting hungry and tired. But just like you and I, sometimes these stories get bored. They are tired of seeing the same things and the same people. And they want to have an adventure. And so they go out into the world, waiting for somebody to speak them. And when they are spoken, they join the world of men. And when they are finished being spoken, then they are tired of the world of men, return to their village, their wives, their children, and wait to go on with their lives. Margot Ostroff quotes this myth as an example of how words are potential, waiting to happen. Because this village where these stories live isn't in some other world, some supernatural world. It's right here, but just around the corner, you know, past the pub, over the hill, and there it is. And you can visit there if you want. So again, the main point of this is to say that words do not transmit things. They don't take essences from here and give them to there. They actuate the possibility that's already there. And again, there is no supernatural world. There is no other world waiting to happen. Where do I want to go next? Back to healing. This is how healing takes place. That the potential to be healthy is still in this poor man's body. It just needs to be actualized. Now, this actualization is done through words, and words, like I said, they're not exactly magical in the Platonic sense. They're more like actual in the capitalistic sense. People in Native American cultures would buy and sell words, literally. When a young man was studying to be a shaman, or a young woman to be a shamaness, because there were plenty of them, he or she would literally have to pay in skins, in work, in horses, in some other object of value, would have to pay to purchase his or her first words. And by words, I don't mean words like or the. I mean words like, what's this? Let me see if I can find that really quick. Where is it? Yeah, that was it. Wakanda Gitu, Gitu Wakanda, Wakanda Gitu. That was not English. That was Omaha. I was born in a city named Omaha, Nebraska. That was Omaha language as it was written down by a woman named Susan LaFleche, who was the daughter of the last chief, if you would, of the Omaha Indians. What it basically means in translation is wonder am I am wonder, wonder am I. And wonder connects to the idea of mystery, connects to the idea of magic, connects to the idea of the spirit. But again, the wonder isn't out there. It's right here and it's right there. And that's where the magic takes place. Let's see here. They buy their magic. That's what I wanted to say. How much time do I have? I don't want to talk way past. Half an hour. Okay, good. There are two basic types of magic that happen in Native American communities. And they're controlled, if that's the right word, from two very different types of people. One is the shaman, or the shamaness, a man or woman who is trained in the use of words and is a professional. Literally, they are responsible for their words. It is not unusual, was not unusual, for a shaman to be held accountable, in other words, to be punished, if their words failed. It was a very strict system. And if the shaman could not use the right, find the right words to activate the healing, the death, and the rebirth. And he wasn't a very good shaman. And he would, basically be pushed out of the community. But the second type of magician was far more powerful than the shaman. And this is the magician that gets very little respect these days. But back then, and well, today in Native American communities, still a lot of respect. But not very many people outside of Native American communities recognize his or her power. I'm talking about clowns, heiokas. Let's see if I can... I'm not going to look it up. I'm not going to read you the quote. I don't have time. Basically, the clown is considered to be far, far more powerful than the shaman. In Lakota culture, a clown is somebody who could not be a clown. Very few people were brave enough to attempt it. Very few people were insane enough to accept the responsibilities of being a clown. There are many different types of clowns. For the Lakota, the heoka is the name of the Lakota backwards clown. This is a man or a woman who does everything backwards, puts their clothes on backwards, walks backwards, speaks backwards. And when the Lakota went to war, when everybody else was going this way, he would run that way. There's famous stories of Lakota clowns running out in front of the rest of the Lakota warriors, turning around and firing his gun back at his own people as a way of doing things backwards. Now, why would doing things backwards make a difference? Well, I'll come back to that. But first, I want to share another story about a different type of clown, and that is the Hopi clown. And from this, I draw on a man... Wait. One more moment about the heiokas. John Fire Lame Deer, if any of you know this name. The Lame Deer family comes from a long tradition of clowns. For many, many generations, the Lame Deers were the premier family of clowns among the Lakota. In the Lakota people, there are two pipes which were said to be given to the original Lakotas by White Buffalo Woman. Black Buffalo Woman was Crazy Horse's wife. White Buffalo Woman. And they're the symbol of Lakota power. One of these pipes is always held by the premier shaman of the Lakota people. The other is always held by the premier heoka, or clown. And for the last several generations, it has been the Lame Deer family. You can find in Czech several of John Fire Lame Deer's books. I know I've seen them. Look for them. He's been translated. What else I wanted to say about John Fire Lame Deer is that he spent most of his life literally working as a clown. A rodeo clown, getting the bulls to not kill the poor cowboys as they fall off their horses in American rodeos. As a clown in theaters, I mean, he is a clown in the Western sense of the word. But he is also a Lakota clown, a heoka, and one of the most respected heokas in the history of the Lakota people. I highly recommend his words. The other type of clown I wanted to mention is coming from a man named Emery Sakaptepewa. I can never pronounce his name. This is a man who is a professor of law at the University of Arizona, a Hopi tribal elder, author of about 60 or 70 books on Hopi mythology, Hopi religion, culture, myth, and clowning. He's also a very, very well-respected Hopi clown. The things the clowns did, ay, ay, ay. Imagine this. Imagine this. The Pope in Rome, with his legal, solemn ceremonies, proper and righteously done, somber, elegant, calm, holy, yeah. And then some other guy runs out on stage, turns around, takes a crap on the floor, and throws it at the Pope. How would Catholicism have been different if that was an integral part of the way religion was done? That's what the clowns did. The reason the clowns are more powerful than the shamans is because they make magic out of their own bodies. The rest of us call it shit and piss. Clowns don't just walk backwards. They eat shit, literally. They do everything backwards, right? And their power comes from this. The fact that unlike the shamans who have to purchase words or find words or discover words, all the clown has to do is squat. And he creates magic. Literally. A sign of how respected the clowns are in every Native American community, a shaman stops at the door of your house, and I do say house because the vast majority of Native Americans lived in villages, in houses, not in teepees on the plains. That's from Hollywood. They lived in houses, most of them. The shaman would stop, knock on the door, and ask to come in. The clown kicks the door open, walks in, takes what he wants, laughs in your face, says, get used to it. This is what life is like. The clown actuates the power of words every moment of his life. A story I can say about Hopi clowns. In the Hopi nation, which is unlike the Lakota, in many ways the Lakota and the Hopi are two very opposed people. The Lakota are a very young people, dependent on horses. They did not exist as a culture 300 years ago. The Hopi are a very ancient people, very settled, living in the same villages for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. But both of them have the greatest respect for the magic of clowns. Among the Hopi, they have the Kachina dances. The Kachinas are the spirits of the dead. The Kachina come back. Periodically throughout the year, they have these dances. Everybody comes to the square. Let me see if I can grab my page so I can... Not that one. This one. The people come to the town square and wait. And there's a whole series of solemn, formal rituals with the shamans, with the women of the communities will save the dust that they sweep up for many, many months and bring it and throw it out in the square, part of the rituals. The priest chants words of blessing, words of renewal, words of life. Then the clowns come. And the clowns don't walk down the street. They climb over the buildings. If there's an easy way to walk, they don't go there. They literally, like, you know, climb over everything to get into the town square. Right? Now, in the town square, with the shamans, there are the kashinas, which are the people who are acting the part or are the incarnation of the spirits of their dead ancestors who live in the village with them. And during the kachina dances, certain people are selected from specific clans, very formalized, ritualized selection process. Dress up in white and black stripes with specific masks on. There are different types of kachinas, warrior kachinas, wisdom kachinas, etc., etc. They're very solemn. And the clowns climb across the buildings and start throwing shit at them. And start stealing from them, trying to pull their clothes off. And the kachinas drive them away. And the clowns flee. And then they come back. Every time they come back, they climb up and they shout, "Yaha, hey! We are here! Hey, everybody!" Well, they do this four times. Each time, they get more bold. They act out scenes of violence and rape and theft. They run up and start humping up against people. They just grab things from people. They act the most obnoxious ways. But then, as the day goes on and as the ceremony goes on, slowly, slowly, more kachinas come into the square. And many of them have whips. And they start fighting the clowns. And they have a big mock war of the dead spirits against the living clowns. And slowly, throughout all of this, well, actually, it's a very sly thing. There's the owl kachina, who is the voice of wisdom. The owl kachina is the wisest of the spirits in the Hopi mythos system. And the head clown will slyly, he thinks he's getting away with something. He will approach and he will try to grab something from the owl kachina. And the warrior kachinas will stop him. And then the clown will act like, "Oh, I'm caught. Okay, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir." And then immediately go back to doing stealing, etc., etc., again and again. This whole scene in the Hopi village takes place over 4 days. Each day the clowns make 4 attempts to take over from the kachinas. Each time it gets more and more and more aggressive. And finally, it comes to a big, big, big battle. Which isn't really a battle, because finally in the end, in the end of all of this ceremony, the clowns are stripped naked and whipped by the kachinas, which is their renewal, their rebirth. And they are whipped and they do suffer pain. As I said, clown magic is difficult magic for the Native Americans. The Hopis are publicly whipped, publicly accept their submission to the kachinas, and are welcomed back into the community And this marks the beginning of the new year, the return of the rains, the return of the season. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but there was Emery Sekaptepewa had a friend that he wrote about, who was another very well-respected clown, who died a few years ago. And Emery is still alive. He's about 70, 80 years old. He's Professor Emeritus of University of Arizona. And as I said, he's a professor of law and a clown. But a friend of his died, and Emery wrote about this man's funeral, what he wanted for his funeral. And the man gave very specific plan. Do this, please. And his family and friends prepared the body. They took him to the tallest building on Black Rock Mesa, this very, very ancient small village. They stood up there and they shouted, "Hey-ya, hey-ya, hella, hella, hey, hey, we're here, we're here." All the people from the village came. And the man's two sons picked him up, one from his hands and one from his feet, and they swung him back and forth over the edge of the building. They did it four times, and then they threw him off. And the body went splat. How is this magic? Well, because it's death and life and renewal. Mostly, we only have 1 hour, and this is an enormous topic. So I'm mostly trying to just paint a picture of the culture and their approach to magic. Words are potential waiting to be activated. But more powerful than words is our own excrement, our own actions in the world, and what we leave behind. More powerful than words is our own shit, literally. And we have to respect it. And any man or woman brave enough, literally, to eat their own shit is somebody to be respected in the community. They have a power because their power comes from themselves and not from others and not from the world. This is painting a picture of the way Native Americans, again, very generally, look at the world. In Lakota language, there are no nouns. Everything is a verb. For example, the state I was born in is Nebraska. One of the main rivers is Niobrara. Nebraska basically means running... Nebraska means water running slowly. But by water, they mean flowing. It's a better way to translate it as flowing, moving slowly. And it literally means Nebraska, flat water, this river that's very slow. And it's a flat state, so the water is like, no waterfalls. Niobrara is another river nearby, which is flowing, running quickly. In Native American way of looking at the world, everything that is potential waiting to move. Magic is done. As Margot Astroff said, words are, what's that definition that I gave you guys again? Got it memorized? Tool designed not to perpetuate, to transmit, or to make a copy of an idea, but to actuate to bring change, to clear obstruction. Words are tools that are used to shake up what has become formalized. As I say this, and as I was looking at this, pardon me, but I am here, and I'm going to mention a dusty American philosopher that many of you may have read, a man named Charles Peirce. According to Charles Peirce, physical matter, and he wrote this 150 years ago, roughly, 140 years ago, physical matter is alive and moving slowly. Living matter is moving quickly. That's the only real difference. That physical matter, rocks move slowly. And he described it as the habit of static, unmoving behavior. We have the habit of moving quickly. We get used to it. We do it. Physical matter is just like us, but it has the bad habit of moving slowly. For the Native Americans, that's exactly correct. There are no nouns. Everything is a verb. Chair, you know, table, room, they're just waiting to move. And words are tools that we use to move them. And the only thing more powerful than that, than words, the only thing that can move this slow, you know, stuff with bad habits, the only thing more powerful than words, literally, is shit. And that's where our power lies. Now, I think about this, I'm here at the Natural Science Faculty, and I'm thinking about chaos theory, complexity, and emergence. The idea of chaos, not as bullets flying randomly, but chaos in the sense of the Lorenzo attractor, chaos in the sense of an aesthetic formulation that returns and repeats itself naturally without external control. Complexity. The more intricate something is, the more it binds itself together, becomes simplicity again. Simplicity emerging out of complexity. Complexity becoming simplicity. And then emergence. The unity of all things doesn't come before the fact in the classic Aristotelian or Platonic sense. It comes after the fact. It is not a priori, it is a posterior. So the unity that is a living being comes after the history of that being. The unity of a culture comes out of the history of that culture. It emerges from all the interactions. The more complex it is, the more likely it is to emerge as a simple, understandable, unified thing. And that's the world. The world for Native Americans is very much alive. Trees speak. Water speaks. There's nothing that can stop it from speaking. And let me see if I can think. Where did I mark that? I wanted to read you one thing on a point, but I don't remember where it is. And if you'll give me just a half a moment. Where was that? Yeah, here it is. This is from a man named Walking Buffalo, a Stoney Indian from Canada. By the way, I'm reading from a book called God is Red, and this is from one of the United States' most respected theologians named Vine Deloria Jr. He is mixed race, half Lakota, half Navajo. not half white, half Indian, but yeah. And he writes theology and religious philosophy from a Native American from a Native American perspective, and this is a best-selling book. He died a few years ago, unfortunately. But here he quotes a man named Walking Buffalo, and he says, "Do you know that trees talk? Well, they do. They talk to each other, and they'll talk to you if you listen. Trouble is, white people don't listen. They never listen to the Indian. They never even listen to each other. So I don't suppose they'll listen to other voices in nature. But I have learned a lot from trees. Sometimes I learn about the weather. Sometimes I learn about the animals. And sometimes I learn about the Great Spirit that you call God." For the Native Americans, that Great Spirit is the trees and the rocks and the tables and the buildings and the chairs. It's you and it's me. And the Spirit is not Platonic in the sense that it has an essence outside. It is not Aristotelian in the sense that it is static, unmoving. Aristotelian physics. We don't do physics based on Aristotle anymore. But most to the point of magic, it's alive. Everything is alive. We just have to listen, learn their language. When we learn the power of words, we're learning how to speak and how to listen. And when we do the magic of the clowns, we're taking from our own a posterior, as it were. That's a pun in English, trust me. And using it to activate the world. Gosh darn it, I thought I would wrap up on a big pun, but I guess the pun doesn't work in Czech, in English. How much time do I have left? Time for questions, or should I keep talking? Because there's... Yeah, it's an hour exactly, it felt like. Okay. Time for questions.
May I have the first one?
No, you. Yes, please. Yes.
Is there a new relation?
Wait for people to leave. I hope I didn't speak too quickly and that it was okay, but all right. Ready.
Is there any relationship between the clowns and the complex of mythology about the tricksters?
Oh, yeah. I could have talked a little bit about that as well. One of the things about Native American mythology is there is no creator. There's no God that made things. Some Native American cultures, especially, for example, the Apache, have something like a creator. But again, the Apache culture grew in connection with the Spanish right next door. And Apache legend also often involves a lot of biblical references. But generally across, when you get away from that, when you look at, for example, the Ojibwa myth, that it was a spider that began the process, or that the earth is an island floating on the back of the turtle. All of these myths, the animals help, and the coyote helps accidentally. The coyote, the trickster, he doesn't want to help. For example, you may know that for the Native Americans of the Southwest, the Athabascan people is the right name for them. That's the Hopi, the Zuni, various other names. But they have an emergence myth. The world wasn't created; it already was. and people climbed up from underground through a series of successive worlds before they got to this one. So they literally emerged from caves. And the coyote came with them. And in one set of these myths, the coyote, just before he emerged, he saw something that he liked. It was a glowing basket. And he wanted to bring it to the new world, because people were climbing up. But he knew that others would want it also. So he grabbed it, and he tried to hide it in his mouth, but it was hot. And when he emerged from the cave, it was burning his mouth so much that as soon as he got out, he had to spit it. And it was a lantern. And the embers of the fire scattered throughout the sky and became stars. So he didn't want to help. It wasn't that he was solemnly helping people. But part of creation came into being because of his selfishness. And connecting with the trickster and with the clowns, in Native American mythologies, there's never a devil. Even among people who have converted to Christianity. When you speak to, for example, the vast majority of the Iroquois today, that's the Haudenosaunee people, they don't like being called Iroquois. Again, it's not their real name. Something like that. I forget what it means exactly, but it's something like that. wait a minute, I just lost my place. Okay. And the world and strange people and all this stuff. Okay. Sorry, give me a moment. Yeah, that's what stopped me, unfortunately, the name I couldn't remember. But well, I'm going to leave them aside because I was going to say something about them, but it fell out of my head. The connection, though, between the trickster... Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm sorry. These people, the majority of them are Christian. A small minority of them follow the teachings of Handsome Lake, who is a prophet of the early 19th century, who reinvented Iroquois mythology to fit modern times. But the majority of them are Christian. But for them, there is no devil. Because God can do bad things, just like good things. And for them, if you want to hurt somebody, if you're angry, you know, your lover broke up with you and you want to get revenge, you pray to the saints. Because the saints are our spirits, our ancestors, who are living in this world, because there is no other world for them to go to. There's no heaven, there's no hell. The saints are right here. And if you want to get revenge on somebody, you pray to St. Peter. And St. Peter will get even for you. St. Peter will make something happen, bad happen to that person. So again, it's like the good, evil, up, down, supernatural, natural, it's all right here. And it's all intricately connected. So the trickster isn't some evil force from somewhere else. Hey, it's part of life. Sometimes it sucks. And why? Because it's here. Just because it is. Don't blame something outside of life. It's just part of life. Sartre would call that an existential dilemma. And the Indians would agree completely.
Well, that was what I had in mind that they imitate the actions of the trickster.
Well, they do deliberately imitate the actions of the trickster.
They behave so strangely.
I don't know if I would say because of trickster, because I'm not sure if I would want to put cause and effect relationship here. It's part of the same worldview. It's part of the same paradigm that that the world is like this, and so part of our religious expression must be, you know, it must resemble the actual world, not some Platonic fantasy world of perfect being, but the real world, shit, tricks, bad curses, ex-girlfriends and everything, you know, part of this world. So, yeah.
I can understand that the Raskin is flowing slowly. That's okay with me. But what about the table or something like that? Do you know some precise meaning or words?
I don't speak Lakota.
Standing solidly.
Standing solid. No. Yeah, something that could be something. But for one thing, they didn't have tables. But.
The house. They have some not moving things.
Yes.
No, they're just slowly moving things.
Well, I want to. Can I? Can I point out? Alfred North Whitehead very famously said that process itself is the actuality. And as an example for that, in Process and Reality, he spends about 10 pages describing how the math and the physical science, describing how if you took a table and isolated it so that it had no interactions with anything, including air, it was in a perfect vacuum, floating outside of gravity. You left it there. In 10 million years or 10 billion years, it would be a pile of dust. Why? Because that's what happens. And so I think this idea that there are no nouns per se is exactly right. And if I can add something from Hakim Bey, things are ephemeral demarcations existing in our minds for our own convenience, but other than that, they have no reality. Things ephemeral, there's no essence to them, there's no reality to things. It's an arbitrary demarcation. Arbitrary separation, arbitrary, random. We do it because it's convenient for us. It's convenient to call this a table. But in social roles, it's more obvious. It's convenient to call me a lecturer, to call you students. Because right now, that's the roles we are playing. But on another day, one of you will be standing here, and I will be sitting there. At which point in time, I'm no longer a thing we call a lecturer, I become a thing we call a student. And it's the interaction that defines both of these positions. So it's arbitrary. So we can say it's a table, but it's not really a table. It's a pile of dust waiting to fall apart.
Well, yes. I am a quite lazy person.
Yes.
And I want to denotate, for example, some rock or
yes.
mountain as some noun, some not moving thing.
Yes.
Because from my perspective, it's not moving.
Yes.
And how to do that without nouns?
Well,
standing.
Yeah, I.
Standing. Being still.
Yeah.
For example, standing.
You could say you could.
Interesting word because it is not causing. Standing.
Really? Standing isn't causing change? If I stand right here, the weight of my feet on this spot of floor is going to affect that piece of floor. And if I move over here, now I'm affecting this one. Oh, but I'm standing. And the standing has effects.
It's an action.
And can I add another little thing? With this about magic again and the power of words, this definition I gave that words don't transmit knowledge, they actuate potential. So again, it's this idea that everything is in flux, but some things move slower than others. And I would argue that this is a closer description of contemporary physics than Plato or Aristotle ever gave us. That this is in motion. Yes? Ah, well, I don't have an answer for you as far as that. I can't explain exactly how they did it.
I think it's not the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
What then is the being who is speaking those words that are actualizing difference, let's say, changes in the world? Or from where is, let's say, its power of actualization comes?
Ah. There's a woman named Ruth Underhill, who's another one of the famous early anthropologists, lived many, many years with the Navajo. She wrote several chapters about a man who was a very poor farmer. And the man said, "Yes, yes, I am very poor. I don't know a single song." That's the definition of being poor. To not know words makes you poor. So it's not because of no rain, no crops. It's not because he's not able to work. It's because he doesn't know any words that would actualize the potential of his farm. It's not just shamans who have words. Trees have words. Rocks have words, waterfalls have words. We just need to learn to listen. The shaman is the person who listens really well. And when I was talking about capitalism, the shaman learns words from trees because he listens and he pays respect. He pays in a different coin, not money, you know, but respect. He gives respect to trees, and in return, the trees teach him words that give him the power to actualize potential. And that's the magic. And in this worldview, everyone can do this. The clowns and the shamans are two different ways of doing it. The shamans work with a formal system. The clowns work with a very, very informal system. You could almost say disgusting system. But both of them are working somehow to actualize potential. And it's something that everyone can do. It's not, so I'm not sure if that answers your question, because...
Okay, I will try to reformulate.
Okay. From where does
the power of actualization that
it's existential
into the words
right.
that are used to
right.
operate?
It's existential. When I say it's existential, I mean that in the classic sartorial sense, as it were. it's.
I think it will help, so please try to somehow broaden your definition.
Okay. yeah. Well, I'm sorry, but that's another pun, because sart and there's the English word sartorial and sart, but never mind that. I don't need to get into that. But it's existential in the sense of. When I say an existential dilemma, an existential crisis, it's part of how the world is built. Because the physical world, the reality that we live in, is basically energy. Some of this energy has slowed into concrete is the word that Charles Peirce liked to use. It has become hardened and solidified. It's become stuff, including the stuff of our bodies. Other parts of this energy becomes formalized in expressions of possibility or words. And so all of it is part of the same general energy that is existence. And so where does the power come from? Well, it comes from the basic energy of life, but it has become narrowed or formulated into a specific word, mostly through history, through happenstance, through what happened in the past, built up and slowly became what is today. And through that, through the series of past experiences, it's become, you know, something. Some of this energy became tables, other energy became waterfalls, and some of the energy became words. But where the words become possible to use is we learned them. We listened. We listened to the trees, and the trees taught us things. We listened to the waterfall. We listened to each other. And I suppose you could say that this means that...
So the words are made from the same stuff as mountains. Basically.
Words are made from the same stuff as mountains.
Just
a different structure. And I was going to say, you could say that people make the words. Let me finish real quick. But people helped make all of creation. There is no creation ex nihilo. There is no God who stood back here and made the world over there. The world came through the actions of so many animals, people, Sky Woman, Walking Water Woman. These are some of the famous Old Spider Woman. These are some of the famous characters that helped create the world. And we're part of it. And that's a really key issue, too. And I'm gonna find something very, very quickly, I hope, because, here it is. And I'm going to come back to you very quickly, but I want to say... when speaking, this isn't when doing shamanistic magic, but when speaking, the Indian becomes part of the creative divinity that lives in all things, germinating and unfolding. Streams of renewal welling up from below, pouring down from the powers above, are flooding his being, and are doubled in strength within him, and he returns it in chanted word and gesture of solemn summoning. The Indian thus experiences himself as an active part of the creative processes of the earth, which are forever progressing and retarding, swelling and subsiding in the gigantic rhythm of the cosmos. The words of power, you know, I could say that we make them, but we make the world, and the world makes us, and the trees help make the world, and the birds, and the spiders, and the coyotes. All of us together create the world, no single act of creation. And that's the other thing I want to add really quickly about magic and how magic works for the Native Americans. Creation isn't finished. In Christianity, 6 days, and then God went to the pub. You might think he should have spent more time. In Native American creation myths, it's never finished. It didn't begin. You know, there always was something.
He will send up from the beginning.
Yeah, well, God is always off in the pub, and we are creating it. We create the world we live in right here and now. So in a way, yes, we also create the words of power. You had something. But I talked way past it.
I have some problems with these so-called informal clowns.
Yes?
Come precisely 4 times a day in the ritual.
In a specific ritual, yeah.
And how is it possible? Precisely
4 times. Okay. Well, that's a good question. A little snarky, but a good question. the clowns take part in the overall ritual. The rituals are, see, this is the thing too, is the shaman has both songs, words that are very rigidly formalized, and ones that he changes for every ritual. But even the ones that are the most formalized are never repeated. Something similar, I didn't talk about this much, but sand painting is another big part of certain traditions, especially the Navajo. It's very similar to Tibetan mandalas, if you know this. You make a very elaborate painting of dribbling sand, right, to create this expansive mandala, which is a recreation of the world, literally. And then at the end of the ceremony, you destroy it. But you never, ever do it exactly the same way twice. But for the shamans, the majority of what they do is formalized. Even though they never do it exactly the same way twice, they have very set patterns that they follow. The clown, in this particular instance, the clown is taking part in the shamanic ceremony welcoming the new year, which is a 4-day ceremony, and the number 4 happens again and again and again throughout it. There are 4 warrior kachinas, there are 4 major clowns, there are 4 this, 4 that. And for that particular one, the clowns are playing off the shamans, so they fit into the shamanic way of doing things. But at the same time, generally speaking, the clowns don't follow a formal ritual sense. And the big difference, of course, is the shamans speak their words in the world, and they learn their power by listening, by learning from others. Whereas the clown is more powerful because he's got all the magic he needs, you know, just waiting to come out. Does that answer your question? Good enough? Okay. Yeah, but I don't mean to... No, I do mean to make jokes. But that's Who's next? See, when I'm teaching a class, I can just point and say, you, what's your question? But I won't do that here.
Thank you very much again.
No more questions? Okay. And thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. I just give it back. Total.